Matheson for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. A top aide to Shiite cleric Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani has been assassinated, along with his son and four bodyguards just south of Baghdad, in an apparent effort to intimidate Iraqis in the run-up to the January 30th elections there. Meanwhile, Reuters is reporting another Sistani aide was killed in a separate attack in Najaf yesterday. Very little is known about that one. Joining us now from Baghdad is Beth Potter. She writes for U.S. News and World Report. And Beth, what can you tell us about what happened in the attack south of where you are?
Sheikh Mahmoud Finjan is a Sistani deputy from the area of Salman Pak, which is actually a mixed Sunni and Shiite area south of Baghdad. It's an area where the weapons of mass destruction actually were thought would be found because there's a lot of nuclear stuff going on down there. He and his son and four bodyguards were killed in the attack that happened last night after prayers.
Beth, do we know who is responsible for these attacks?
I don't think that it's clear yet who is behind all of these election-related attacks, but today the journalists heard from General John Batiste, actually, a little bit about the insurgents who they think are trying to create this unrest in advance of the election. And he says that they are former Baathists, obviously, but also an increasing number of foreign fighters, which the military has said all along. They keep on linking such attacks to Zarqawi, who's a Jordanian terrorist who's believed to be linked to al-Qaeda.
And did he have anything to say about the goal here? Does it appear to be simply to scare the Shiite voters away from the polls or perhaps to incite civil war between the Shiites and Sunnis?
I think the journalists want to withhold judgment on that question, actually. You know, in recent days, a lot of the election posters have gone up around Baghdad, at least, and many of them have pictures of Sistani on them and just a general message telling Iraqis that it's their duty to vote. It basically says something to the effect of, if you don't vote, you lose your voice in society. So I don't know if this was a message to the people who put up those posters or if it's something more general.
Well, it certainly might be seen as intimidating.
Well, and already, you know, the election workers, we keep hearing from various election workers around the country about how they think as it gets closer to elections, they're going to have to resign or go into hiding. So I think people already are feeling quite intimidated. If you talk to voters, everybody says that they want to vote. But when you ask them, will you go to the poll, it's very hard to get somebody to say, yes, I'm going to go, and everyone in my family is going. What you usually hear from a young male is, you know, how can I take my mother? You know, it's already dangerous enough for me. What if some shooting starts or something? How will I protect her?
And Beth, let's remind our listeners who Ayatollah Sistani is and also his role in Iraqi affairs.
Ayatollah Sistani is one of the five main Ayatollahs actually in the Shiite Muslim world, the main Shiite Muslim cleric in Iraq who is not involved directly in the elections, but is supporting, is behind the scenes in one of the main lists of the United Iraqi. The list is called the United Iraqi Alliance, a coalition of 16 groups that includes Iraq's largest Shiite political party, the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq. So usually when Sistani says something, Shiite Muslims, especially in Iraq, will do what he says. He's issued a fatwa saying that people should turn out and vote.
Well, tomorrow we're going to be looking more deeply into how ready the country is for elections, which, of course, are now only 2 weeks away. But can you give us a sense of what people are saying about these attacks? We spoke earlier about how intimidating they were, but you know, how are people horrified by this? Are they scared by it? Do they simply think that this is inevitable given what has been happening in the last few weeks?
It's interesting, Gail, that you asked that. You know, I think Shiite Muslims really feel like this is their time, you know, that they're going to vote no matter what because they're finally going to get a chance to be involved in political life in Iraq when they've been denied so long a chance at that kind of power, if you will. And obviously anything related to Sistani, people get very upset because they see him as their religious leader. But it's almost as if he's higher than your average politician. It's not like you would say, oh, you know, say, for example, if President Bush was injured or something, I think the whole nation would be on tenterhooks, you know, what happened. But this is more just a message to the Shia who it probably will strengthen their resolve, at least among the people I talk to.
Beth Potter writes for U.S. News and World Report. She joined us from Baghdad. Thanks, Beth.
Thanks very much.
Each year, more than 60,000 defendants are sentenced in federal courtrooms around the country. The jury decides the guilt or innocence of a defendant. Then the judge determines the sentence using federally imposed guidelines. Yesterday, the Supreme Court issued a two-part ruling about those guidelines that is raising questions about people already behind bars. Lyle Denniston covers the Supreme Court for Here and Now and also contributes to the online weblog called SCOTUS Blog. And Lyle, the first part of this ruling is about the judge's role in determining sentences. What did the court say?
Well, the Supreme Court in the first part of its decision yesterday, Gail, said that when the judge seeks to impose a penalty, he or she can do so only based upon the facts that were found by a jury. That's a requirement of the Sixth Amendment jury trial, the court has said in several decisions over the years, including the one involving state guidelines last June 24. But when the court confronted that yesterday, they said, yes, indeed, our prior decisions do apply to the federal sentencing guidelines so that the judges ordinarily would not be able to add more sentences to that which would be justified by the jury's determination of the facts of the crime. That part of it appeared to limit the discretion of federal judges to follow the guidelines in any respect. But then there was the second part of the decision.
Right. And the second part is about whether judges have to impose sentences just on these federal guidelines or whether they have some leeway?
Yes. The second part of the decision, which was an entirely separate ruling written by a different justice, Justice Stephen Breyer from Boston. And in that ruling, the court declared that because of the first ruling, some parts of the federal sentencing guideline law are unconstitutional. But it found that the only parts that were unconstitutional were those that made the guidelines mandatory. What the second part of the ruling means, Gail, is that these guidelines continue on the books, but they are no longer mandatory. They're no longer binding on the judges. The judges are obliged to consult them, but do not have to feel bound by them. And then the judge's decision as to the length of the sentence in federal cases will be determined on appeal, if they're challenged on appeal, according to a standard of whether they are reasonable or not, which is a pretty open-ended standard.
Mm. And Justice Breyer wrote in part of yesterday's ruling that the ball is now in Congress's court. So what do you think Congress is likely to do about this?
Well, Congress has been very nervous for 20 years about letting federal judges have complete discretion because some members of Congress thought that the judges would use that discretion too aggressively and impose harsh sentences. And other judges would use that power too leniently and impose lighter than the sentences ought to be. So Congress tried to set up a system of uniformity. Now, what yesterday's two rulings combined result in is a restoration of discretion among the judges within some limits. They're not open-ended, complete discretion, but a good deal more discretion than they've had under the mandatory guidelines. Congress, I would expect, is going to try to do something to restore its control over federal sentencing and to diminish somewhat that amount of discretion that the court restored yesterday. They will be able to do so, however, only if they stay within the constitutional limits that the first part of the ruling did. So Congress can act, but it can act only within a fairly limited range, I would think.
And what about all the people who are already in federal jails? Are we going to see a flood wave of new appeals because of this decision?
Oh, there's no question about it, Gail. There will be thousands, perhaps tens of thousands of appeals. There is a question as to how far back this ruling applies. The court said that its ruling would at least apply to cases that are still pending in the first review in the appeals courts, but it didn't say whether the ruling would be retroactive to the time when the guidelines were first put into effect.
Lyle Denniston covers the Supreme Court for Here and Now and for the weblog SCOTUS Blog. Thanks so much, Lyle.
All right.
We now turn to Robert Sindrich, who served as a judge on the U.S. District Court in Pittsburgh for 9 years. He resigned from the bench last year in part because of his concerns about these federal sentencing guidelines. He joins us on the line from his office at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center, where he is now chief legal counsel. Judge, thanks for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
So a two-part decision here. What's your reaction to the first part?
Well, the first part, I think, was predictable. Anyone who ever read the Sixth Amendment knows that it provides for a right to a jury trial for all citizens who are accused of a crime, and that the proof must be beyond a reasonable doubt. And that's just what the court said.
How about the second part? Because in the past year, we've seen something of a revolt by federal judges around the country against the notion that they could not exercise judicial discretion as they had in the past, that these sentencing guidelines were there, that they needed to be bound by them. What's your sense of that?
I have problems with it. I rather agree with the dissent. I'm not sure that the court can legislate in the way it has, in other words, to change the guidelines from mandatory to advisory or recommendations. If the guidelines are merely recommendations, then the district court is free to not follow them, but then the appellate or reviewing court will use the guidelines as the baseline and make a determination of whether the district court's decision was, quote, unreasonable, quote. And so we have a ruling without a standard to apply.
Does this put us right back where we were 20 years ago, when the concern then was that defendants in one part of the country could get much lighter sentences than defendants for the same crime in another part of the country?
You know, I really don't think so. The guidelines in almost every state that has them are advisory or recommendations, and they work pretty well. The studies show that judges do tend to follow the recommendations or guidelines and that they sentence within them. So if Congress chose to reenact this law more in the nature of state court guidelines, then I think it will work pretty well to avoid sentencing disparities.
When you resigned, you said the guidelines were part of the reason that criminal cases are not going to trial in federal court. I assume that's because so many of them are being plea bargained. Why is that a bad thing?
Well, I don't think the founders would have put a right to a trial by jury in the Constitution if they didn't think it was something important, a right that citizens could exercise. There is, of course, a coercive effect on a person's exercise of that right when, if they take the jury trial and lose, their sentence might be double or even triple that which is offered to them in a guilty plea bargain. And I don't think that's right. I don't think we should chill the exercise of any constitutional right.
And you think that was being held over their heads? In other words, you better make a plea bargain now because you could do much worse if this goes to court.
Yes, I know that that's the case. That's exactly the bargaining strategy used by the government. Either take what we're giving you, whether you think it's too much or not, or if you go to trial, we'll add on this count or we'll claim this enhancement and you'll get more.
Robert Sindrich is a former U.S. District Court judge. He spoke to us from his office in Pittsburgh. Thanks, Judge.
Thank you, Gil.
There's more coming up here and now. I'm Gail Harris. It's Here and Now. In today's New England Journal of Medicine, there is a disturbing study on the hazards of physicians in training working long, extended hours. Researchers at the Brigham and Women's Hospital found that after working overnight extended shifts, exhausted interns were much more likely to get into a car accident while driving home from the hospital. Past studies have shown the long overnight shifts can harm patients as well as interns, but in this study, the researchers found that the shifts of 24 hours and more are also hazardous to the public. Well, here to lend some insight into all of this is medical journalist Dr. Terry Schrader. And Terry, I'm sure you must remember your days as an intern. What do you make of these findings?
I do, of course, Gail. Thanks. You know, anyone who has known someone who's gone through medical training or who themselves have gone through medical training knows that it's just part of the territory and the tradition, the long hours. Traditionally, you can be on every third or fourth night sometime during your training, and that means really working overnight through the night. To give you some perspective, in this study, the average interns across the country, and I think it does represent most interns, worked an average of 70-hour weeks, but nearly half of them work between 80 and 120 hour weeks. So we're really talking, you know, these are the equivalent of 2 and 3 job kind of schedules. And then what was of most concern to these researchers were it was the long shifts. About once a week or 4 times a month, these interns were called to work an extended or marathon shift that lasted on average 32 hours. So that's 32 hours of working at the hospital. Some of them slept, but the average amount of sleeping was about 2 hours, 2.5 hours in that time period.
So how was this study conducted?
What the researchers did was to follow 2,700 interns. These interns filled out questionnaires about their work hours, their extended shifts, and about documented car accidents. What they found was that after working an extended shift, this is one of those long, over 24-hour periods, the interns were twice as likely to have a car accident and 5 times as likely to have a near collision. I spoke with one of the authors, Dr. Charles Seisler, about the findings concerning these so-called marathon shifts.
The marathon shifts are dangerous for patients, they're dangerous for the physicians, and they're dangerous to other motorists. The alternative is to have interns working on a schedule in which they never exceed 16 hours of scheduled work.
And Gail, that's really his, I think, message, is that these long extended shifts are the hazards. It's not even really the weekly cumulative total. It's these long extended shifts. And one could call these findings really the canary in the mineshaft, and I think we all should pay attention to them and make sure changes are made.
Well, you have to wonder, this has been brought to public attention for some time now, the hazards of doctors working too many hours. There are other industries like trucking and airlines that have regulated hours. So why are these long shifts continuing for doctors in training?
3 reasons. Tradition, the perception that you'll become a better doctor the more hours you work, and third, and what few people outside the system may know, the economics of resident training, and really that this represents a labor force. Here's what the study author, Dr. Seisler, said about why it may be hard for hospitals to immediately give the interns fewer hours, even after a study like this comes out.
Interns and residents, during their training, are providing a tremendous amount of patient care, and the government reimburses the costs of the salaries of the physicians in training. But if the hospitals have to replace those physicians in training with physicians who have finished their training, the cost is much more expensive and it is not reimbursable to the hospitals.
Well, Terry, you certainly went through your own internship. What did that feel like? I mean, what is it like to work 24 or 36 hours straight? Are you able to focus at the end of that time? I'm wondering how you even get home after 36 hours on the job.
Right. Well, I think becoming a physician, the training of a physician is quite different than any other profession. People recognize and acknowledge that there are all sorts of stresses in the system. Diseases don't have a shift mentality, and really neither do doctors. I mean, if you talk about people who go to medical school, they tend to be high achievers. They want to become good doctors. They want to see the patients through. And many times they don't want to leave. They want to keep working and learn as much as they can. But I think it's the responsibility of the training programs to provide a supportive, rewarding educational training experience, and a safe one, too, because if we're not going to train physicians in a caring environment, they're not going to be able to care for their patients, and they're not going to become the kind of physicians we want them to become. I was fortunate and went to a very supportive system, and you always had people around you could ask, and there were others that were senior to you that would help out, and the intern isn't the highest person, obviously, on the responsibility scale, but they do oftentimes carry the longest hours.
Well, how impaired is someone who has been up for that length of time working? Is it a little bit like being drunk, that you have a much slower reaction time on the road?
It is. There have been numerous physiologic studies that looked at the impairment equivalence, if you will, when someone is sleep deprived. And what they found is that with 24 hours sleep deprivation, you are the equivalent of 0.08 to 0.1 alcohol impaired, which is, of course, over the legal limit, is considered drunk in all states in the United States. So one cannot stay up more than 24 hours working and not be physically impaired.
Well, how likely is it that changes are finally going to come? Because this is something that people have been aware of for a long time.
Well, there have been recent changes. There have, of course, been many cases in the literature and in the press, reports of medical errors, et cetera. I think all of this has put pressure on the institutions and the profession to make some changes. There have been changes made. Last summer, the 80-hour work week was instituted. But I think studies like this say, let's keep going. And perhaps this particular study will even make some of those changes happen quicker than they might have if this study had not been published.
Terry, thank you.
You're welcome, Gail.
Terry Schrader is a doctor of internal medicine and a medical journalist. She joined us from the studios of WRNI in Providence, Rhode Island. Tomorrow on Here and Now, Iraqis are scheduled to vote at the end of the month. We'll speak with an election official in Iraq's Kurdish region about getting people in and out of the polling places safely. That's tomorrow. Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now. I'm Gail Harris. It's Here and Now. Indonesia is tightening control over the movement of foreigners in the tsunami-affected region. The government has now ordered the army to accompany all foreign aid workers in the Aceh province, and foreign troops may be asked to leave by the end of March. All this comes as the worldwide death toll from the tsunami reaches 157,000 people. Aid workers are struggling to meet the basic needs of survivors, but a growing problem is the psychological trauma that survivors are facing. To help us get a grasp of the emotional toll of this disaster, we turn to Dr. Tom Borneman. He is director of the Carter Center's mental health program. Dr. Borneman, welcome.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Since the tsunami struck, we have, of course, heard many traumatic stories about parents watching their children swept out of their arms and into the floodwaters. In some cases, children have lost both parents. Whole families have lost everything they own. How do you deal with this kind of profound psychological trauma?
Well, these experiences are among the most difficult that any human being can possibly experience. We've learned from past disasters that the death of a child is one of the most difficult events in the life of a person. Even those who witness the death of a child, or even the body of a child who has died in the course of a disaster. So we know whenever there's a major disaster where children are involved, and involved as extensively as children were involved in this one, it is a severely traumatizing event. People will spend their lifetime getting over it, and what we would encourage them to do to begin that healing process is when they're ready to begin to reengage with their communities, with their other family members, with their spiritual advisors and others who have had meaning in their lives prior to the disaster.
So it is possible to get over something as difficult, as devastating as watching a child drown right before your eyes?
You never completely get over something like that if getting over means forgetting and letting it go completely. What you can do, however, is begin to resume a level of functioning, begin to manage it, and put it in the context of your larger life and other contributions you can make in your life. Will you ever completely get over it? No, I wouldn't think so for most people. Can you begin to adjust and get on with life? Yes.
And what about from the standpoint of the children? We heard one story about a 6-year-old boy who was orphaned by the tsunami and who seemed to be blind. There was nothing physically wrong with him, but his eyesight seemed to come back after A woman took him in, treated him like her son, and then he said he could see again.
Right.
Is this the sort of symptom that often appears?
You've described the scenario that happens for many people, whether child or adult. Remember that our normal psyche is not prepared for the extraordinary stressors caused by a disaster, and one particularly of this magnitude. So we react in a variety of different ways, unique to the individual, in order to help manage this kind of overstimulation of fear and trauma and terror. And sometimes it can be in a dissociative state or a state in which we disconnect with our current reality. And what often helps bring us back is stable, consistent nurturing. And certainly in the case of children, that's vital. For children who have suffered such profound losses as the loss of parents, particularly both parents in some cases, the availability of stable, nurturing adult figures are going to be quite central in the recovery of that child.
One of the other stories that I was reading about involved the loss of 114 children from a children's home out of 150 children who were there, and that these children weren't told what had happened to their friends. How important is it for them to hear the truth?
Generally speaking, you want to tell the truth. You don't want to tell it in a way that overwhelms a young and impressionable mind, but you want to do it in a way that communicates to the children of where their friends are and what's happened to them, and to communicate to them that they are now safe.
Do children tend to recover from this sort of trauma more readily than adults?
Children are remarkably resilient. They have the very effective ability to come back from pretty adverse events. There need to be some preconditions that help children achieve that, and adult supervision is among those very, very key things early on. And to reconnect with family members that have survived is also quite important, and to reconnect with other staple people in the lives of those children are quite important.
Do you have any sense at this point as to how many of these survivors are going to face psychological problems and need special help?
We would estimate, based on previous disaster experiences, it may be up to 90% of the people who were exposed, directly firsthand exposure, will have some type of psychological distress associated with such a horrendous event. Now, over time, this will abate for the vast majority of people, and typically in disasters, you would think in the neighborhood of 25% may go on to develop some kind of psychological distress that may require an intervention. But by and large, most people will begin to recover over time.
And what happens if they are not treated?
Well, often they can go on to a long-term syndrome that can be, for some people, disabling. For others, may begin to affect their normal levels of functioning in their roles in life, whether it is as parenting or as a worker, as a colleague, as a marital partner. It may go on to affect their ability to function in those roles. And those roles are vital to our integrity as a human being.
It's fascinating that there are some cultural issues here as well. You know, in the West, we tend to think that talking about things is a great way to solve problems, but that's not necessarily true in this context.
That is true. You know, culture is always an important factor to consider. The workers going in certainly need to respect and understand the cultural context in which they're entering and adjust their services accordingly. You need to know the spiritual context. You need to know the social and economic. Kinship rules and things of that sort are important in most societies, particularly more traditional societies.
Give us a sense of the specific differences. In some cultures, people might view this as God's punishment for wrongdoing, that sort of thing?
Yes, exactly. You know, in certain religious traditions, they may see it as God's vengeance for acts in a past life, for example. Some religious leaders are using this experience to talk about sin and evil doing in their society, and that this is God's vengeance for that. So it may be explained in a variety of different ways. We should not go in and assume, particularly foreign workers, should not go in and assume people are going to be able to explain and contextualize this disaster in the same way that you are. So one of the key components of field workers going in to provide disaster assistance, and particularly health and mental health workers, is to first and foremost listen, and listen carefully. Help to provide the very basic services that people need. Help them to reconnect with people important in their lives. Certainly be a part of the larger disaster response team to ensure their safety and security and that their basic needs are met, such as food and shelter and clothing.
Dr. Borneman, thank you so much.
My pleasure, and good luck.
Dr. Tom Borneman is director of the Carter Center's mental health program and has also developed a national mental health program for refugees. He spoke with us from Atlanta. Still to come, alcohol has been a key part of many an artist's life. We look at the role it played in the works of two American writers. You're listening to Here and Now. Tougher penalties are on the horizon for baseball players who use steroids. Today, after months of pressure to act and some damaging drug use admissions, players and owners unveil a more stringent drug testing plan. But some critics are already calling the new plan ridiculous. And if that isn't enough sports news for you today, there's this weekend's football playoffs. So here in the studio to talk about it all is Bill Littlefield, host of WBUR's Only a Game sports program. Hi, Bill.
How are you?
Very well, thanks. So let's start with this drug testing. Players like Barry Bonds and Jason Giambi have reportedly admitted to using steroids, but no player was suspended for steroid use last year. What does this new agreement say?
Well, the new agreement is a little more strict than the old agreement. You get suspended the first time you get caught, although the suspension is only for 10 games, and everybody who knows baseball knows that 10 games doesn't constitute much in terms of a baseball season. The rules and penalties that are established in this new version of baseball's drug policy are still far short of the World Anti-Doping Agency code, and in fact, they're even short of the rules that are evident in minor league baseball. So it's not exactly it's a little more than a slap in the wrist. It's not much more.
But a light one. Well, in fact, a World Anti-Doping Agency official said it was ridiculous because it doesn't include amphetamines and that players have used those for years.
Yeah, that is a problem with baseball. The baseball has gone through eras where they used to call them greenies, pep pills, and then, of course, there was a cocaine scandal or three in baseball as well. So none of that stuff is addressed in the steroid thing. I think baseball is trying in a public relations move to say, hey, look, we are doing something about the Jason Giambis of the world, and they're trying to convince fans that they are concerned with the way the sport is perceived.
Well, as you say, though, is it mostly PR or is this really a good agreement for baseball?
It's a good agreement if you look at the history where there was essentially no agreement. I suppose it's good in that regard, but I don't think it's going to change very much because in all other sports, it's the same. Athletes find ways to try to enhance their performance, and as soon as people in the science community figure out how to catch them, they find some other ways, and it takes a while for the catchers to catch up with the people who are breaking the rules.
All right. Well, moving on to football, we have four division games this weekend. Last year's Super Bowl champs, the New England Patriots, are going to try to beat the Indianapolis Colts for a second time this season.
Mm-hmm.
Can we put you on for a prediction here?
I have a hope. I'm not sure I have a prediction. I'm on the record as hoping for a very high-scoring game featuring 75 passes from each team because I think it's
75?
Great fun to watch. Oh, yeah, absolutely. The running back should just sit back in rocking chairs and watch this one. Peyton Manning, of course, the quarterback for the Colts, is great fun to watch. Everybody's choice for MVP this year. And if he's on, the Patriots will have a tough time because their secondary is even more depleted than usual by injury. So they've got several guys playing out of position. They've managed to cover up the flaws thus far. But this will be a test if Manning has a good day.
All right. St. Louis Rams v. the Atlanta Falcons.
Michael Vick is the show in that one, throwing the ball for the Falcons. And Vick, of course, has the versatility. He's one of those relatively rare quarterbacks these days who can tuck the ball in and run. And so he should be great fun to watch, especially, again, if he's having a good day.
Vikings v. the Philadelphia Eagles.
I don't know about that one. I have to root against the Vikings just because of my fear that if the end Moss makes another catch and he'll come up with some more ridiculous and a hideous, shameful display of foolishness, even worse than last week when he pretended to be taking his pants off and mooning the fans behind him in the end zone. I'll root for the Eagles in that one.
All right. Quick call on the Jets versus the Steelers.
I read an article today, Gail, that said that should be the closest of the four games. I don't buy it. Seems to me the Jets should be happy just to be there. They needed Buffalo to lose to even get into the playoffs. I like the Steelers.
Bill Littlefield, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Bill Littlefield is host of WBUR's Only a Game sports program. Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. I'm Gail Harris. It's Here and Now. Recapping our top story, the mounting violence across Iraq as elections approach. Overnight, south of Baghdad, a representative of Iraq's most senior Shiite Muslim cleric, Grand Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani, was assassinated along with the aide's son and four of his bodyguards. Sistani has called for Iraqis to vote in the January 30th elections despite the violence. Also today, gunmen in Baghdad opened fire on a minibus outside a hotel, killing six Iraqis and kidnapping a Turkish businessman. North of the capital, a local councillor was shot and killed, and a roadside bomb killed an Iraqi police officer. Near the Syrian border, an Iraqi National Guard captain was assassinated. But Beth Potter, freelance reporter for U.S. News and World Report, thinks the violence may motivate some Iraqis to participate in the election.
I think Shiite Muslims really feel like this is their time, you know, that they're going to vote no matter what, because they're finally going to get a chance to be involved in political life in Iraq when they've been denied so long a chance at that kind of power, if you will. And obviously anything related to Sistani, people get very upset because they see him as their religious leader. But this is more just a message to the Shia it probably will strengthen their resolve, at least among the people I talk to.
Meanwhile, a U.S. congresswoman who has just returned from a visit to Iraq says she has never had an experience like it. Republican Kay Granger of Texas says she and three other lawmakers went to Iraq to give women candidates there some campaign advice, and instead learned that the biggest challenge the candidates face was how to avoid getting killed.
They're the bravest women I may have ever met in my life. Not only are the voters being threatened, these women are being threatened. They're literally risking their lives and the lives of their families to do this.
At least one-third of the candidates on the January 30th ballot in Iraq must be women. One female candidate was found murdered last month. The list is long and the stories harrowing. It is well known that many giants of American literature loved the bottle. Hemingway, Fitzgerald, Faulkner, just for starters. And I could probably spend the next 5 minutes or so rattling off many more names. But I'll leave that to Kelly Bowler, author of the new book, Drinking Companion, Alcohol and Writers' Lives. In the book, she tells the story of 15 writers who couldn't stop drinking and couldn't stop writing either. Recently, Kelly Bowler spoke with Here and Now's Bill Marks about the role alcohol played in the lives of some of the 20th century's greatest writers, and also her reasons for writing the book.
I like to think it's dishy, kind of part literary, part tabloid, but it was not meant to just be nasty. It was meant to be more a way of looking at how alcohol ran through their works and their differences in style of drinking. I'm not an academic and I'm not a doctor. But I dealt more with the stories behind the stories. One thing that I found that I hadn't expected to find was this insane capacity for helplessness. Out of the 15 that I wrote about, I'd say 12 of them pretended they couldn't use a telephone or they didn't know how to write a check. And this was after they were rich and famous, and they just, thank goodness, very few of them could drive a car. and they were just staggeringly helpless.
Now, you don't really deal in the book with, sort of the genetic explanations for drinking versus, let's say, social or, you know, cultural explanations. It seems as if the writers themselves a lot of them, they seem to accept the fact that they've chosen to be alcoholics, but we now know that may not necessarily be true.
Certainly something that I became more aware of as I went on was how much mental illness was involved and how many, a huge amount of these people were self-medicating in an era when the only treatment for serious mental illness was Thorazine or shock treatment. And it's amazing that they didn't do more serious things than just get drunk.
But you also point out, I mean, sort of ironically, that all of them were prolific writers. I mean, Jack London, for instance, despite the enormous amount of alcohol he drank, he still managed to be incredibly productive.
Yeah, one of the things about Jack London is he wrote 1,000 words every day. He had a grueling work ethic, and he would have a drink of rye before he started, then he'd have a drink at the 500-word mark, and he'd have a drink at the 1,000-word mark. But he wrote every darn day, and almost all of them did, with the exception of perhaps three. Dashiell Hammett had a writer's block that lasted for 40 years, but with the exception of him and maybe two others, they all wrote almost until the day they died.
And now let's talk a little bit more about London. I mean, he's a fascinating case. And London was very much a sort of very macho guy who essentially, and you indicate in your book, blamed his drinking on the fact that he hung out with the men at the bars and they drank, and so he drank.
Well, he had his first drunk experience when he was 5, and he was carrying a pail of sudsy beer from the pub straight to the fields where his dad and some other men were working. The pail was so heavy that he decided to drink a little bit of it to lighten it, and he got drunk and never quite made it. But he also had to drop out of school when he was 13 to help support his family. And he worked 10 and 12 hours a day. This was before child labor laws. So very understandably, he found his way to, when he was 14 and 15, found his way to the bars and pretty soon was drinking on the waterfront.
You also point out that like author Kingsley Amis, Jack London also wrote a book about drinking. It's called, and it's a classic, Jack Barleycorn. And it says a lot about alcoholic revelation. Did that reveal what the sources were of Jack London's drinking, or was that a sort of a cover-up?
Oh, no. He was staggeringly honest in a way that probably only somebody who was rich and famous and had lots of bravado could be. But he also had no intention of quitting, giving up drink, which was an irony because that book is even now sometimes used in recovery. And the irony is that when he wrote it, he had no intention of giving up drinking.
Now, the next writer I wanted to talk about is Anne Sexton. She really sort of made a performance.
Yes.
out of being drunk. In other words, she'd go to her poetry readings, for example, and she would be soused, and the audience expected it.
Yes. And that didn't start. She started off drinking in a very 1950s way with the cocktail hour, where she and her husband would have a martini in their suburban living room, and then that would turn into another martini, and then another, and supper would just get later and later until when it was finally on the table, she might do something like fall face first into the mashed potatoes. Then as she became more famous and more of a celebrity, drinking became part of her shtick almost. And there's this great quote where she's writing organizers of a series of readings that's supposed to take place in the Deep South. And she says, "This is to inform you that if Virginia is a dry state, that I need to be in a semi-wet state before the reading."
And certainly, as you point out, for a number of these writers, they made hell for the people around them because somebody had to pick up the pieces.
It's amazing. They had a staggering, inhuman capacity for selfishness, especially at the expense of their families. One thing that's certainly interesting is that pretty much today we wouldn't stand for this kind of drinking. In the 20s, 30s, 40s, and 50s, though, the families covered it up and made it possible for them to keep drinking.
Did you come to any conclusions that alcohol was a stimulant to the imagination?
Sometimes it definitely was. It wouldn't be honest to say that it didn't. But inevitably, it ended up taking over the talent and the creativity. And even though I said earlier that they all wrote every day, very few of them wrote with the kind of quality or talent or ability that they did before alcohol took over their lives.
Author Kelly Bowler speaking to Here and Now's Bill Marks. Kelly's new book is called A Drinking Companion, Alcohol and Writers' Lives. Thank you. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Gail Harris. Get into your radio and join us again, Here and Now. For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Gail Harris. Join us.